B. Jackie, Joe Hartzler, one movie, three microphones. What do you need, a road map? Today, we discuss the Coen brothers' Hollywood mindfuck, Barton Fink. JFIO presents.
What? Are you kidding? We got us a family here.
This ain't no Coon, huh?
Okay, I'm not gonna sit here and debate.
I'll show you the life of a mind!
You will find a fortune. It would not be the fortune you seek.
I suppose you think you're raised hell.
When I'm raised hell, you'll know it.
Something is very wrong. I don't want Santana Abraxas. I've just been in a terrible auto accident.
What's the most you ever lost in the coin toss?
Sometimes knowledge is yours.
Accept the mystery, a Coen Brothers podcast.
We are back on Accept the Mystery, a Coen Brothers podcast, where we take about every Coen Brothers movie one by one in absurd, encyclopedic, excruciating line-by-line levels of detail. My name is Josh. It's a very hot day in Los Angeles, but that's appropriate for this movie. And I'm joined by a dog today. Hi, Chaya. What's up?
That's my dog.
It's
She's
your
the
dog.
Best.
And I'm also joined by my co-host, the awesome Jackie Luckholtz.
Ugh, I hate movies.
Oh, wow.
What? Jackie, why do you hate movies so much?
Ugh, I hate movies.
You're not explaining yourself. Why don't you like this movie?
That's so unrealistic.
What's unrealistic about it?
I'll allow it.
You'll allow what?
I'll allow it. I'll allow it.
We have a soundboard now.
It's the best soundboard ever. Case dismissed.
She every episode we seem to come up with a new catchphrase for Jackie, and now I have them all at my fingertips.
Let's see what I come up with today.
I mean, you almost don't even need to be here.
Great.
As long as I can like drop gems like this.
Ugh.
That's all we like. Just, you know, anytime somebody drops a joke and we just throw in a
ugh.
That's perfect.
Is this what makes you feel powerful?
It actually is.
This is the first time we have the soundboard, so it's not even a joke. Thrill.
I feel like
what is the soundboard?
What is the soundboard?
Yeah.
Well, it's just a bunch of like sound effects that I press.
Case dismissed. It's only me.
It plays her catchphrases.
Case dismissed. Oh, so you've like organized these?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that he can interrupt me with my own voice.
I'll allow it.
Oh yeah.
It's Wait, sorry. Great. What did you say?
I'm not falling for this.
That other voice on the other microphone you hear is a comedian, an improviser, a writer, the host of Funny or Die's Boy Search series,
yeah.
And our teacher, among other things.
Yes, it's Teach.
Please welcome Joe Hartzler to the show.
Come on.
Welcome, Joe Hartzler.
Hey, thanks, guys. Happy to be here.
Yeah. I don't know. What credits would you want me to say if I'm going to list all the credits?
Boy Search is one. And you got to mention Trophy Case. That's
please.
The only thing I love right now.
I do have to mention the inimitable Trophy Case series, 1, 2, and 3.
No.
The last I heard, it was A World Without Trophies.
Yeah.
Are the trophies back yet?
No, not yet. I'm still on hiatus, but... I don't know. There's rumblings.
All right. Well, that's very exciting. We are here, though, to discuss a film. But before we even dive into that film, we need to get inside our guest. And this is a segment called Inside Joe Hartzler.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2.
Oh, no!
Which is the segment where we ask our guest questions loosely inspired by the movie of the week.
Oh, great.
Are you ready for this?
I like this. You guys are so prepared. I like you have bumpers. You've got stuff going on. It's great.
It's almost like a real show. Almost.
It is.
Kind of.
We're getting there.
It's odd that we're talking about Barton Fink and right now there's wallpaper falling off of your walls.
I mean, there usually isn't wallpaper on my walls.
But today.
I also dropped a swarm of mosquitoes into my house. Hopefully that won't bother you guys too much.
Yeah.
Joe, the Hotel Earl seems to be constantly on the verge of falling apart, like you mentioned. Full of mosquitoes, seems like just a terrible place. What's the worst hotel experience you've ever had?
The worst hotel experience I ever had?
Or a bad hotel experience you've had? We don't have to go to extremes.
Oh, I've got a good one. Oh, man, yes. I should not talk about this story. You know, I've stayed in many hotels. I've traveled on the road and... I've lived in hotels and I travel a lot.
So you've been a res.
I've been all over. Holiday Inn, La Quinta. What do you want to talk about? I've named two hotels.
You have named two hotels. Super 8.
Ramada.
Traveler.
Red Roof Inn. Yeah. Super 8. Econo Lodge.
Isn't it like Motel 6?
I've stayed there.
Are Travelodge and Econolodge the same? I think they're the same company, but they're different
names. Maybe
there's
a parent company there.
Yeah,
they're
just the lodge company. Mm-hmm.
But I've stayed in a lot of hotels, And man, I don't know if I can talk about this story, but I'm gonna do it.
Do it.
I was in New York, where it's the prohibition of marijuana is still strictly enforced, and some people I was with were partaking in the marijuana.
Can I mention that a lot of my listeners are DEA agents?
That's where you're both from.
Yeah, I'm a lawyer, so she's a lawyer.
And I like, you know, I'm glad this story came up too, because I think we're at a crossroads. I think we're starting a lot of changes. I read some very exciting New York Times op-eds recently. I think people are starting to smarten up about the prohibition of marijuana.
Absolutely.
Because I think it's a pretty destructive thing for our country.
Oh, no, 100%.
I think we've overturned alcohol prohibition, and it's ridiculous that we're still locking people up for marijuana. But some people I was with in this hotel, I was in New York, I got out of the shower in the morning, the room smelled, and I was instantly, I had a very bad feeling, because it's like, we're like 13 floors up or whatever, and the worst thing happened, which is a too stern knock on the door, and it was hotel security, and everyone looked at me, and so I went to the door, and when I tried to open the door, there were towels on the floor where
to
try to block the smoke.
I know the technique.
And so it got caught on the door, and I saw just a flash of a smile, and then dead serious. And this very intimidating person says, is someone smoking marijuana in here? And I paused, and I had a choice to make, and I chose the wrong thing, which is, I was honest about what was happening.
Why would you be honest?
I should have said...
You're going to be like, you know, we're cool here. I can say I've smoked, right?
What I should have said was, no. But what I did say was, yeah.
Oh, chill.
And then I tried, like, just being like, oh, I'll make sure this never happens in my room again. I didn't, you know, right? I tried to really be really nice. And this person flung the door open and said, you have 10 minutes to get out. I'm calling the police. Which is probably an appropriate response to someone's confession.
Yeah, I mean, it's better than stay here and don't move. I'm calling the police.
Yeah. I guess it's better than that. But I really tried to reason with this guy, and I was like, but, you know, there's just a big difference. Like, in California, it's just, the attitude is totally different.
Yeah.
So
it's practically legal here. It's effectively legal.
That would never happen here. And they did not refund our money. I want to name the hotel. Should I do that?
Call them out. Call them out.
But maybe I shouldn't.
For their destructive practices.
I don't want to stir up anything.
All right, that's cool.
You know what? I was hanging out with people I shouldn't have been hanging out with. Bad influence types.
Yeah, the wrong crowd.
I
have smoked marijuana in a hotel room in New York City. I definitely had. I think I went overboard with it.
You did.
I mean, I was by myself, but I barricaded myself in the bathroom. I laid washcloths on the floor. I turned the shower on hot so that there was steam coming out, because you figure like the steam is going to mix with the smoke, and it's just all going to seem like steam.
Smelly steam.
The smell.
I don't think it would enhance.
I don't know.
Not that I noticed.
So you've got a marijuana steam room happening.
I'm like in a sauna, and I think it was actually like literally sitting under the sink so that the smoke would just collect underneath the sink instead of going out into the rest of the hotel.
Yeah.
Good story.
Nobody should do drugs.
No. Even marijuana. It should be legal, but don't do it.
Don't do it.
It's a message of accept the mystery. In the film Barton Fink, there are movie executives, and they're based off real figures like Jack Warner and Louis B. Mayer. I don't think movie executives act like that anymore.
So great.
In your experience, I don't know how much experience you've had talking to movie or studio executives. Do they act like that?
100% of the time. In fact, I thought they played those characters very small.
Too small, you're saying.
Far too small a portrayal.
Yeah. Should have been just screaming and knocking over papers. And
Yeah. Who's that actor? He's so good.
Which one? Who played Lipnick?
I mean, they're all so good, but...
Yeah. No, yeah, there's Tony Shalhoub, who played Geisler, and then
the main studio boss.
Yeah, the main boss was Michael Lerner,
who gives the line, "I run this town, you read the papers."
That's such a great character. I think he was nominated for an Academy Award for that one.
Ooh,
yeah.
So good.
Yeah, one of those just great big performances.
Chaya has come to say hello to me, and I could not be happier about it. I really like
we just got a big friendly dog walking around here.
Chaya. You might hear her panting a little bit. Sorry, guys.
That's okay.
It's hot in here.
You just assume we're panting.
Yeah.
Trying to relieve the heat.
I think I love the way they capture this idea, how they portray the Hollywood execs. He starts to write the story for him before he leaves the office. It's so funny.
Right. No, you're already figuring out whether you got the orphan or the dame, but not both. That's crucial.
Not both.
That screws with the formula. Barton Fink is tasked with writing a wrestling picture. Have you or are you a fan of wrestling?
Yes.
Yes. Yes and
very
yes.
Much. Well, okay, here's what, and I love this about this movie is they show both kinds of wrestling. They show professional wrestling, professional wrestling picture, and Goodman's character does actual wrestling.
They've got that moment where they actually
get down,
just demonstrates a move.
Yeah. And I was a wrestler, and I think it's one of the most honest, brutal, beautiful sports that there is. I think it's...
It's one of the first sports, and there's something primal about just two guys just going at it for pure strength and finesse. You know?
Yeah, it made me a stronger human being, not just like physically, but like I think it made me like far more confident and stuff. Just having that discipline and having worked that hard on something.
Were you in high school?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just because I don't know, it's just so demanding. It's such a grueling sport, and you have to, so our conditioning and stuff for it was ridiculous. But I wasn't great, but it was like I got my ass beat a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've officially tried, like my last boss encouraged me to try a few jiu-jitsu moves, and I tried it. It's so hard. It's just, it takes like to actually like stay in there and not just have like that kind of primal instinctual freak out of, oh, somebody's attacking me.
Yeah.
How do I actually pull a move and counteract what this person is doing? It takes like a lot of skill.
Yeah, and it's funny. I did my fair share of ass kicking too, guys. Let's be clear. But like, if you haven't wrestled, you can't describe like what you have to do. Like you only learn it by just wrestling a whole bunch.
Mm. Right.
When you haven't wrestled, like the first time I walked out on the mat, I did not know what was happening, and it was a horrible experience.
And it thematically makes a lot of sense here, where, you shouldn't be trying to write a wrestling picture if you don't have a sense of...
Don't let me talk about high school wrestling when we're talking about Barton Fink, guys. Please, let's go talk about Barton Fink.
All right. Barton's neighbor is Charlie Meadows, who's an insurance salesman. Have you ever been a door-to-door salesman or a salesman of any kind?
I worked for my dad for a while. He sells manufactured housing, pre-manufactured homes, modular homes, mobile homes, guys. We sell trailers. Pretty decent houses. But when I was just out of high school, and I worked there growing up, either doing landscaping or working on the houses in some way, or being on site in some way. But I started working in the office thinking that I could be a salesman. Mm-hmm. Well, no one wants to buy a house from an 18-year-old kid.
Aww.
But I would just end up talking to people mostly, answering questions, and then directing them towards more capable, seasoned
right. Yeah. Salesmen. Yeah. It's like, hey, you've never owned a home. You're 18. You probably don't have
what do
to
I know about
car.
Anything?
Yeah, yeah. Cars or homes.
Yeah, but I could answer the details. I know the difference between a HUD-built house and a house built to the Ohio Basic Building Code.
Oh,
wow. Okay.
HUD-built home has a steel frame that stays on with the house. The HUD-built home comes on a steel carrier, but then there's just wood floor joists underneath. Or it's considered
mobile.
Real estate.
Oh,
gotcha. You know what? That's what I assumed, but I didn't just want to say that.
Yeah. A lot of people jump to conclusions.
I don't want to jump to conclusions, exactly.
Let's talk about fart fake and not mobile homes.
I was really briefly, for 2 weeks, I was a door-to-door salesman.
Yeah, you guys, were you selling? What'd you sell?
I don't even want to say was it exactly a salesman. This is when I was in school up in Santa Cruz. I did a little work with the Sierra Club. Which was, this was me going door to door and getting people to donate to global warming, or fighting global warming. Not donate to global warming, because that's make the world hotter. Even in Santa Cruz, which is like as friendly a place as you're going to get for that kind of thing, just having to walk up to people and look them in the eye, you know they don't want to be bothered, and ask them for money is the worst thing in the world.
Did you ever succeed? Did you ever get money from people?
I probably talked to like 200 people for the 2 weeks I worked, and I made maybe $100.
Wow.
Yeah, nothing. Couldn't get
that
anything.
That is why we're in the crisis we're in. That's why we don't have water to drink in Southern California.
I know. It's all because nobody, I mean, everybody knows it's a problem, but nobody wants to give.
You're pounding the pavement.
I'm pounding the, I was trying. And those are the people who believe in global warming. I also actually, and they tell you not to get in arguments with people, but sometimes there are like people who believe global warming is a hoax who just want to like engage you. And I couldn't stop myself from being like, okay, you're telling me like Obama made up global warming. I can't like not try to say you're a moron. And so, and but they say, if you know what you're supposed to do is just say, okay, thanks for your time, and move on to the next house. But I would spend 15 minutes there trying to say, look, it's a real thing, guys. Wasting my time.
Oh, Josh. Have you ever sold anything?
I haven't. I mean, I've sold, you know, things out of catalogs. I think he has like wrapping paper. What were those catalogs when you were in elementary school?
Oh,
like
yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Something like gift wrap.
Real good gift wrap. Yeah. But besides
and then you
that,
sell the kids to peddle the peddle wares.
Yeah.
And then if you sell enough gift wrap, you win like an ice cream social.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sending your kid door to door. Pass a levy.
Okay, before we get to the movie itself, I have one last question. Barton Fink ends the film with a box that he never opens, and we never find out what's inside. What is an applesauce machine, and why did Susie Barrett tell us to ask you about it?
Oh my gosh. Maybe I should give you Barton Fink's poetic answer.
No!
Sure. Which is, I don't know. We're all the applesauce machine.
Oh man.
I guess so.
Okay. The applesauce machine is it's my high watermark at UCB, I think.
Oh, no kidding.
Well, it sounds like it, and we want to know what it is.
It was in a Besser workshop several years ago, and I was on the team Flapjackson, and we'd been doing this crazy like organic opening, but it was like an opening that used a lot of different openings, and it was kind of like a specific kind of opening that we did. I'm trying to get backstory to justify that what's about to happen, but it won't justify it. Everyone's very nervous in Matt Besser's workshop. He can be intimidating, and everyone wants to do well, obviously, and make a good impression, right? There's a lot of really funny people in that room, and I remember we all got up on stage, and Besser asks, all right, what kind of opening do you guys do? And someone was like, organic. But all these different Herald teams were in this workshop together, so we hadn't practiced an opening together. So as soon as I realized, like, oh, we're going to be doing an opening with all these people, I have the thought in my head of, I hope we don't do one of those really shitty organic openings, you know? And and then I did exactly my worst fear, you know? Like, I walked right into it. It was like I was a deer in the headlights. But so then the suggestion was applesauce. No one steps out.
Right.
No one moves. We're all standing there, and I know that you can't have dead air. You got to do something. So I did the smart top of my intelligence choice and went from applesauce to applesauce machine.
Yeah, somebody's gonna make applesauce.
A machine that makes applesauce.
I bravely stepped out and started turning a crank. And no one else stepped out. And I'm just standing out there just turning a crank, not saying anything, not engaged with anyone else, not providing any more information than that. It was just turning a crank, and a very long amount of time went by. A very uncomfortably long amount of time went by before, reluctantly, everyone else stepped out and started turning cranks.
Oh my god.
And making applesauce.
Yeah, everybody's working on the
applesauce. And at the end of it, we had an applesauce machine and nothing else.
Oh my god.
There was no other information, and it was maybe one of the worst things I've ever done on stage.
No, that doesn't sound like you're bad. It sounds like everybody else is bad.
Yeah, for not supporting you and trying to say, so hey, what's this, an applesauce machine?
But it became a metaphor for throughout the rest of the whole class. And
a metaphor for what?
Basically just like, you know, if you don't get information, you'll just be stuck with this applesauce machine. What are you going to do with that? You know, it was like,
oh,
basically an example of like the worst. And Which is totally right, you know.
I guess, but it seems like everybody else should have gotten out and done something. Yeah. Like, if you're turning a crank.
Yeah. Maybe, yeah.
Like, if you're turning a crank, maybe. Somebody yeah, could, like, go out there and
there's
join
something mechanic,
something.
Mechanical happening.
But I can't remember exactly what Bezzer's... Exactly what how he addressed it and what his response was. But it was something about get some information in there and, like... How about play with what you know and, like, you don't find yourself stuck inside an applesauce machine, unable to get any more information into a scene.
No.
You're just turning the stupid crank. Like, that is an example of a bad organic opening.
Let's move into the review of the movie of the week in a segment we call The Big Review Ski. Yeah! Yeah! Barton Fink, released in 1991, starring John Turturro and John Goodman, the first ever Coen Brothers film to win the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival. Cannes Film Festival?
Cannes.
It's one of those.
Can't.
The Cannes Film the Festival, can't. Where the films that can't hack it go. This is a movie with a lot of things going on. It's a Hollywood satire, it's a buddy comedy, it's a love triangle. And by the end, it just turns into, like, a murder mystery and then, like, just a surreal, you don't know what the hell is going on. Mm. And I love it for all of those things. It's uncategorizable up until the very end. And it's one of those movies that there's so many possible interpretations of everything that's happening. Because every line seems like it's laden with symbolism about what's going on inside this main character's head.
Yeah. What is it? The world of the mind?
The life of the mind.
Life of the mind.
Yeah. Mm. I'll show you the life of the mind.
I have a theory that the film Barton Fink that we see is the wrestling movie that Barton Fink turned in to the studio.
Oh, wait, you think Barton? Do you think the film Barton Fink is the Burly Man? That's the name of the script he writes in the movie.
Yeah, and I think what we see is the story that he turned in at the end that's box office garbage because it has a poetic ending. You don't know, find out what's in the box. I think that's the box office poison that and the poetry that Barton was hoping to give to the world.
Oh, yeah.
And because it also... It has that, but he tried to give the studio some things, too, because the movie Barton Fink is also violent. There's sex. There's a woman dead in the bed, mysteriously. There's FBI cops that feel like they're right out of, like, gangster movies.
Right, it's all those tropes that you feel like should be in those B-pictures of the time.
Yeah, and...
Those noir pictures that the Coens have taken a lot of influence from in their previous movies we talked about.
Yeah, and that's when, at the end, when he scolds him, he's like, there's poetry in the ring, Barton. There's poetry in the ring. It's like he's kind of right because the movie Barton Fink is not a wrestling movie. There's wrestling in it, but all the poetry happens outside of that.
Right. No, and yeah, it's in many ways what you're describing sounds a lot like the film Adaptation.
I was just going to say, exactly.
Yeah.
It's like
which another one of those great films about writers and writer's block, which by the third act completely transforms into just everything he said he was against, but actually makes it into the film.
Exactly.
That's a pretty cool, like, metatextual interpretation.
Mm.
And there's definitely moments and there's definitely shots that really put you in the that seem like they're shot from Barton's point of view shows up a lot of times.
Well, especially at the end when he's on the beach and he's you know that painting it's his woman on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
It's look guys, this is a movie about Barton Fink's fear of sex, fear of maybe homosexuality, fear of his humanness, and at the end he gets this fantasy, which is like this really clean fantasy sex on the beach kind of scene.
It's interesting you mentioned fear of sex because that's a place to go to off the bat. That wrestling scene you mentioned,
it's so good.
The Coen brothers explicitly describe that as a sex scene.
Yeah, definitely.
And you see John Goodman on all fours and he's looking back and he's like, come on.
Yeah. It's so sexual. And later when he's being interrogated, he blurts out, sex! He's a man! We wrestle!
Yeah.
It's so good.
That, and also the first time you see Charlie, who knocks at the door, and Barton doesn't want to let him in, but he says, I'd feel better if I buy you a drink. The entire time, you can tell Charlie is essentially kind of seducing this guy.
Yeah.
Trying to get on his good side.
Yeah.
Maybe to eventually infiltrate his life and just fuck with him in numerous ways. But
and the whole thing comes down to, you came into my home.
Yeah.
Complained about the noise.
Yeah.
I love that part.
You're a fucking tourist with a typewriter. I live here. Which I think that's an awesome theme. Like, I think, well, okay, let's try it. I think Barton Fink is pretentious, and I think that
undoubtedly
writers inherently are pretentious, and if they're not careful, like, feel that they're separate from their subjects.
Yeah.
And this is kind of a cautionary tale in that respect of what happens when you, the writer, goes off the rails and stops caring about what his subject is supposed to be and just starts thinking about your art and you create. I'm a creator.
Yeah.
This is my uniform.
Yeah, he's a snob. He's a snob.
Yeah, totally.
And we don't know at the beginning if he really is this great writer. Like, you don't know, like... Because you just see the end of his play. You don't really know. Maybe the critics just loved it. Maybe it's garbage. Maybe, you know. Yeah.
A couple things about that first scene, and which it's brilliantly shot because all you see, well, most of it is focused on Barton's face. Yeah. But the very first thing you see is the stagehands, and most of the action is focused on, you know, just the normal people, again, the common men who are just kind of lifting the curtains and putting on the scene beforehand. Mm-hmm. Everything he's supposed to be writing about, but he's not looking at them.
He's in a different world.
He's in a different world.
And he even, like, sort of gives a condescending look to the guy who says, fresh fish, right?
Yeah.
He, like, gives him a look
what are you doing here?
Reverie, yeah.
Something I did not know until I looked up some trivia about the movie, the guy saying the lines on stage is John Turturro.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's the actor in that play.
Oh, cool.
Hear. Yeah. That's so awesome. He's basically, he's listening to himself say his own words.
That's great. So he's so far up his own ass. So that's great.
But then something that I did notice, and something that you hear very few lines out of the script he writes at the very end. But one of them is, it ends on, wherever he is, we won't be able to send him a postcard. That exact same line shows up in the first scene we see.
Oh, great.
Oh.
He's just copying himself, essentially. Great. He's just coming using the same cliched phrase he used at the beginning.
Yeah.
I think all the clues point to the fact he's not a very good writer at all.
Yeah, and how he downplays the reviews so hard in the first thing, but as soon as he's in Hollywood, it's the first thing he brings up in the office is his reviews. You know, as much as he tries to, you know, downplay them, and he's like, oh, I don't care about the reviews, I'm for the art,
right.
I'm this close to this art, blah, blah, blah. As soon as he sits down for a meeting, he's like, oh, I've got very good reviews.
They read the review to him, the New York elite read the review to him, and then later his agent says, oh, have you heard this review yet? And he said, no, tell me.
Yeah, yeah.
He really desperately wants to hear the praise, as much as he says he's above it, and he's all about the theater, art.
That's so unrealistic.
Wow.
I just wanted Jackie to
I felt like you guys were, you know, getting to something, and I have some commentary, but it'll
come on, bring it. I feel like we're steamrolling it a little bit.
Don't worry about me, especially when we get to the quiz.
Okay.
But
well, I did hit the...
That's so unrealistic.
Because I think you did
The whole... Yeah. Okay, no, what did I think? Tell me what I thought.
No, you tell me. You tell me what you thought.
Okay, tell me what you think I thought. I'll allow it.
I just know that you, while we were watching the movie together, we watched it last night, and I think at moments you were like, wait, how is this possible? How did she get murdered? We don't understand how she got murdered.
Yeah,
how did
but that just... wasn't as much my complaint. You know what? I have small points that I wrote down about some things that were unrealistic.
Okay.
But you know what I thought was unrealistic?
What?
Was her just coming over like that in the middle of the night to help him. I get it that it was necessary for some part of the movie, but... Maybe that was also part of his, like, fantasy, and we don't
for
know
sure.
which part is real or not.
It
but
could,
I was like, what do you mean she just came over to help in the middle of the night? Like,
it completely could be. I mean...
I always have problems with things like that.
I mean, I'll mention my big, broad theory about Barton Fink, which is essentially everything that takes place inside the Hotel Earl is not real.
Very possible.
Then that hotel is basically a metaphor for... his mind and his writing process.
The life that of the works.
Mind. The life of the mind.
Well, and at the end, remember when he says that so much wrestling with the soul? Well, a little bit for the critics, but, you know, right?
Yeah.
I thought that's what Barton Fink's about. It's him wrestling with his soul, pretty much.
Right, yeah. Very much, yeah. It's almost like a lot of... Him and Charlie could both be seen as kind of just manifestations of different parts of, like, his process. I think basically Charlie is not a real person.
I think Charlie also kind of represents the devil, right? Like, Hollywood is hell, and he's kind of the center of it.
There's a lot of biblical stuff going on in this movie.
Yeah, totally. Like just the walls are sweating, just the heat and the fire that come with Charlie. You know,
but you know what? That point too about, like, you know, not to be a Barton, like to be so self-obsessed, and the fact that he. You know, wasn't listening to him like when he was talking in the beginning, you know?
Yeah.
That's supposed to be like a lesson, I think, too, because, like, well, that's one of the immediate things you think of, which is like, yeah, dude, like, you're not listening to him at all. But then, like, the guy was already like a murderer before that. Mm-hmm. And he was also like the thing that he ended with, the thing that tipped him off was like, you know, you came into my house and didn't, or and complained about the noise.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, how would you have not done that almost too? I mean, maybe he was just being too picky, like too obnoxious to think.
Well, he should have come to his door and knocked on it like had an actual conversation with a human being instead of trying to mm-hmm. hide in your own little world.
And calling the hotel instead. I guess so.
I also think there's a few like jolting events throughout the movie, like the when the girl is dead, and there's one of those huge shocker moments
that you don't see coming.
I died.
And there's like the huge change that takes place in Charlie, and he becomes Munt, right? I think those are all examples of like the script being written. Right. And it's like, so he's deciding to like make these, you know, he doesn't know what the story is at first. So that's why I think the huge change that takes place from Charlie becomes Munt. I think he's trying to turn this into a box office.
Right. Like,
he's a serial killer.
Right. Adding in the serial killer elements later because it's going to be more provocative.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Because I think at first, sensational. And especially the way he plays it, he's two different people, you know, it's like he's so sweet. In the early scenes.
Now, having watched this a few times and now knowing where John Goodman's performance goes, but watching those early scenes, it is possibly his best performance. It's just amazing. But those early scenes where he does seem all sweetness and cheer and just a really nice guy and wants to talk to Barton, I watch those and I see a lot more like contained rage, and I see that.
I saw that too because I watched it for the first time, as you know, and but I thought that like he was apologizing so much when he was like, oh, I really do apologize.
Yeah.
I thought it was too much too, so I was like, something's not so.
No,
about
he
this
like
guy.
A, he essentially forces his way into Barton's house, and,
well,
and
And how about when he slaps himself? There's the moment of violence. Yeah. It's kind of like a Lenny in Mice and Men. He's like, oh, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that to you.
Yeah, yeah, that's weird.
Yeah,
very weird.
There are signs.
A couple of the times where he says, oh, I could tell you some stories. And Barton immediately says, yeah, I bet you could tell me some stories. That's what I'm all about, you know?
Yeah.
And they cut back to John Goodman, and you could kind of see him getting pissed off. And,
sure do care about it, he says.
I can tell this means a whole lot to you.
Yeah, I can tell this means a whole lot to you. Great.
Or when he says, to put things in your terms, it's as phony as a $3 bill.
Yeah.
You know, just this epic level of condescension. And John Turturro's performance too is so good, and just
so good,
so good at playing this just pompous, marmy guy who's way too high on his own supply.
Yeah, but also so neurotic and so relatable in that way. I super related to him much more than expected.
Yeah,
because that whole process of him like trying to write, not being able to write, I was like, that's me all the time. I can't do it. It's so hard. So
I totally
I'm not
relate
as obnoxious
to that.
As him, but I totally
if I don't relate necessarily to the character, I totally relate to the position he's in.
Well, and doesn't even the one of the words that we see in the screenplay is fishmongers, which would be the guy that yells the thing off stage in the
fish, fresh fish. Yeah, he's reusing the same stock characters he used in his old play.
Okay, I love this scene. This is one of my favorite scenes, which I think is hilarious, is when he goes to watch the dailies.
Oh yeah. I will destroy you.
And it's just like, he's so judgmental of that. He doesn't understand the process of Hollywood, and he views that as I think it's both Barton's ignorant of the process of Hollywood, and he feels that it's artistically bankrupt, that there could be no value there, which I think is part of his flaw, is that he's so judgmental of Hollywood that he'll never be a good.
This is something that was fascinating when I was reading other people's reviews of this film online, is that because people are coming at this movie with different perspectives, I saw a whole lot of critiques of this movie saying Barton's problem is he decided to go to L.A. and sell his soul to the devil. He should have been working on his real art instead of condescending to make B pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he finds himself trapped in L.A. And I'm like, you're reading this 100% wrong. The problem is he thinks he's above these B pictures.
Yeah. I think there's definitely that interpretation. But I think more and more it's that he's a snob. It's that he thinks he's above the process. And he doesn't take the time to learn about Hollywood, about how to write a Hollywood movie.
Yeah, he doesn't bother to watch a movie. He talks to, you know, he finds W.P. Mayhew and talks to him, but he doesn't bother to like really learn anything about writing from him.
Yeah.
Just kind of chews him out.
Yeah.
It's
fully just self-obsessed and solipsistic.
Yeah, but I think I can also understand like his desire to make something that's like artistic, and but I think he failed at finding the art in something that's maybe not as like highbrow as however he perceives art to be. So I agree that he was
being
a snob.
There's poetry in the ring.
Yeah.
There is,
like, if
there is poetry in the ring.
But if he's so concerned about like the common man and, you know, this whole thing, it's like, well, just find some art in the common man in Hollywood who wants like a B movie or something. But but I still do relate to his need to like figure out the art and what he was doing in order to be able to do something. So like when he's trying to write and he just like can't find what the purpose is. But I mean, that was just his problem. He needed to find it and he was too much of a snob to do it. But
right.
I understood that whole like neurotic state of like, well, but I don't even know what this is going to be. And I can't write anything until I know everything and understand it.
Totally trapped in his own head.
Yeah.
It's worth pointing out as we're talking about kind of, that this is one of the great writer's block movies.
Yeah.
That it's so good at painting that process.
It was amazing.
And the dust where the pencil, broken pencil, led, that's such a great...
Great little detail, and the visual details are all on point. But I think the sound design, especially, is so on point throughout this film. Is
you
incredible.
You pointed that out; that was great.
Every is hotel room in the Hotel Earl. Every little sound, every little footfall is amplified. Every time he makes a step, or he taps on the window, or he hits on his bed, it's like this loud, huge sound.
Yeah,
and it mimics the feeling of having writer's block and feeling like every little thing that could happen is a huge distraction that knocks you out of that.
Yeah. That's like before the, you know, Instagram, Facebook, like things to distract you. It's just like noises in your room.
Right.
And like things happening in the room.
Right. Yeah. Every little mosquito, things keep knocking you out of it.
Yeah.
My favorite piece of sound design, possibly in the whole Coen Brothers canon, is when Barton first gets to the Hotel Earl and he taps on the bell.
Yeah.
And the bell just rings for like 60 seconds and doesn't stop. It's such a good way to set that eerie tone.
Yeah.
And they stopped it.
And it's like, wait, is this still going? And then you don't even realize it's going until Buscemi comes up and taps on it.
Yeah.
It's like, it just paints a picture of this place. It's just swampy and you can feel the heat and you can feel the wallpaper dripping. The Coen brothers pointedly said that The Shining was an influence on this film.
Oh, cool.
And you can see similarities between, like, the Overlook Hotel and this hotel.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Like, the walls sweating. It feels like a living thing.
Yeah.
Not like an organism.
Completely.
Yeah, it was gross.
Completely.
It was totally alive.
Which is part of what feeds into my theory that this place is, it's like you're inside his head. It's like you're inside this place.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like his own sweat rolling down the walls.
Exactly like that. And you notice the ways that what happens in the hotel mimic things that are going on outside. He doesn't hear sex noises coming from the other room in the hotel until he meets Judy Davis's character in real life. And suddenly, like, it's like those sexual urges have like activated in him, and suddenly he's hearing that. And then Charlie steps in and he is asking, do you have a girlfriend, Barton? And he shows him his tie, which has the girl on it.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's like, this is all just reflections of what's on your brain right now.
Yeah. It's his own. Is Barton Fink a bisexual? And does he is he afraid of the side that's attracted to?
Also playing into it, I think, is the fact that because of his own artistic pretension, he desperately wants to be this W.P. Mayhew guy.
Yeah.
This great novelist, to the point of wanting to steal his girl. And that scene there is totally, it's like, I'm stepping into Mayhew's shoes, I'm calling his muse over, and I'm like banging her in my room. Yeah.
Which was all surprising to me. I just couldn't really see that really playing out. Like,
You just kind of don't believe she would actually go to his room after all that?
No. I mean, that's okay. It was, you know, if it's his own
that's
mind,
so
that makes
unrealistic.
Sense. Oh my gosh.
How does it feel to be interrupted by yourself?
You know what? I love it. Case dismissed.
Oh my gosh.
Why is this happening to me?
How are you ever going to have a serious conversation with this podcast?
This is ridiculous.
I wish I could carry this around with me when we have conversations in real life.
I'm sure you could put those little sounds on your phone.
I could. I probably could.
Oh, you could have used that sound effect, but I actually made it. Anyway, no, I just kind of didn't buy that, but I think it does make sense. If that's like what his fantasy was, then sure, she would have come over and helped him in the middle of the night. But she just didn't seem attracted to him really before, so that's why I was like,
right. In most of the scenes, it was more like, I'm talking to you, but I'm still clearly attached to this Mayhew guy, no matter how much of a crazy alcoholic he is.
Yeah.
Also noteworthy to point out that this film was written during a period of actual writer's block for the Coen brothers. They were in the middle of writing Miller's Crossing, and they
Miller's
were like
Crossing is so good too.
Yeah, also a very cool movie, but that was such a complicated plot.
Yeah.
And I think they had trouble connecting all the strands. So in between, they took a 3-week break and just knocked out Barton Fink.
Wow.
Huh. According to them, they just kind of burped it out. It was one of those things that arrived fully formed.
You know, what I regret right now is I thought about insisting that I'd watched Barton Fink, but talking about Forrest Gump. All of my details would be from Forrest Gump.
Oh, God.
You know what? Life really is like a box of chocolates when you think about it.
Yeah. And I love that Barton gets to be with Jenny.
Yeah. It's such a sweet ending.
It is a sweet film.
And he got to meet JFK. Yeah, but and because this was written during a period of real writer's block for the Coens, I think it's easy to read autobiographical elements into this.
Sure.
And also the fact Barton Fink looks a little bit like Ethan Coen, you know, with the glasses
also
and the
Buster
hair.
From Arrested Development.
Also a little like Tony Hale playing Buster on Arrested Development. I can see it.
Beaker the Muppet.
Or that. But there were just like certain he would almost put like his hand like under his chin and be like pondering in that very Buster way. I was like, you look like Buster.
Buster, who's also kind of like this like fake academic sort of.
Just his eyes are funny. But you know what? I'm speaking of Miller's Crossing too, and I noticed that in that movie as well. There's something about their female characters that are slightly off to me. Like being the female voice here, I'm just going to say like you need like two more details to make me believe that this woman is into this guy. And I feel like that connection's always missing and it's bugging me.
I'm not going to disagree with you, at least for the Coen movies we've seen so far.
Yeah. Like Arizona. Yeah.
I agree, but I think it was intentional, you know, in this
Maybe.
One. Like, I think in this movie, like, the, you know, she's the dame that they're talking about when they're talking about writing. So,
exactly.
Like, I think that's why they're a little thin.
Yeah.
And especially think about the girl at the end, like, that's Barton's ultimate fantasy. She's just like this humble, are you in the picture? She's like, oh, no, don't be silly. And she's like randomly comes up and talks to him. And she's like dressed very sexy and just like seems very naive. It's like, and he's still bunched up in his suit.
A lot of the female characters here in particular are very symbolic.
No, I could see how it could be intentional too. But even if this is all because it's like his fantasy in his head or like him writing a lame movie, I think it'd be interesting to see like a couple more details where you see that moment like in her face where it's like, this is why I'm into said male character.
I get it. I get why you'd want her to be more developed because she's not incredibly developed here. She's not, and she is the dame, but she's also a muse in a very kind of classical sense.
Yeah.
You know, she's the guy who's coming up with all of Mayhew's ideas.
Right. Like if she's that woman, I don't get why she's going over suddenly to Barton's room.
So here's a hot topic. Sorry, I just interrupted you.
Oh, use one of my sounds on him right now.
Oh, yeah.
Ugh. There you go.
Okay, I deserve that. This is a hot topic. Is the manic pixie dream girl is like come under fire, lately, and that term has come under fire because
it does show up in so many indie movies. This girl who kind of only exists to make the male protagonist like go through his journey.
But isn't that what like that's the muse is the original manic pixie dream girl? Like that's not it didn't get invented with that term. It's like that's an old writing thing.
No, that's
so
true.
In stories. So are you saying then it's like part of that character is that there's no real reason that she's into him?
Well, I'm just saying that I think that trope is part of like our culture in a deeper way than just like Garden State. Like I think it's been there for like thousands of years or whatever. The muse.
I think I think it's one of those things that ebbs and flows.
And I think the muse is inherently a thin character that tends to be like a plot point for the male.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, no,
I can see that.
I mean, it's interesting that you draw that thread, and I do think culturally, sometimes you see women who take more agency and seem to have more of an internal life, and sometimes they seem to step back again. You know, I think like the screwball comedy era, where women seem to be really driving the plot and kind of controlling the action. Since then, we have gotten back to a state where women seem like, and this is true of female action heroes as well. We see a lot of female characters who are kind of stone-faced and they kick butt and they seem super smart for the first two acts of the movie, but then they still need to get rescued by a male hero in the third act of the movie. Ultimately being like, you're superficially this awesome, super cool, tough girl, but at the end of the day, you're still playing second fiddle to the real manly man guy.
Yeah. As it should be because of the Bible.
Yeah.
No, all fair points. I still think there's just got to be something. there's always for me like something about like the human relationships. I want them to make a little bit of sense, because we all do stuff that like kind of doesn't make sense. Like we're all like dating somebody doesn't make sense, or like something happens.
Are you dating someone that doesn't make sense?
Not right now, but like kind of recently, I was like, what the hell? So it's like
you're, it's like you're speaking Pig Latin to me. I literally don't understand anything you're saying.
So I think like it happens. We're all like, whoa, like why would that happen? But then there's always like a little reason, and so I just would want to see that little speck of reason. That's all.
Yeah, I think that's a more fair critique for films like Blood Simple or Miller's Crossing, where the female characters really should be characters but are not.
Yeah.
Here, I think a lot of the characters, male and female, are kind of a little bit thinly conceived, but it's on purpose. And if you really want to take the muse angle further, when Barton only starts writing, the first thing that happens before he actually figures out how to write his screenplay is he picks up that box, that's Charlie's package, and he like... he shakes it and he like holds his ear to it.
Yeah.
Like he's listening to like a seashell, like and crashing waves. And there's a lot of theories for what's in the box. It's never revealed what's in the box. But Jackie, I know that your acting theory is it's
her head.
It's Audrey's head in the box.
Yeah.
Which I think is a fairly strong theory.
Yeah, I think it's definitely suggested that that's what's in the box.
Yeah, but I just want to point out that I knew it from the second you brought the box in.
No, you totally you totally called it.
I did.
But Barton gets his ending. Wait, what? Do it again?
Case dismissed.
Yeah, oh my gosh. It.
But it's almost like he interpret that he was listening to like a seashell. I thought he was trying to figure out if it was really a head, because that was right after he had talked to the cops. So he was like, does this sound like a head? I guess so.
Oh,
I'll
no.
Write this movie now.
I think that's totally what's supposed to be going on. But I think, but it's interesting that it's like, if she's the muse, it's like she's whispering to him kind of from beyond the grave.
Deep,
and then he starts writing, you know? And I think more than almost any of the Coen Brothers movie, except maybe A Serious Man, this is one of those things where you can look into every single scene and see how it can be interpreted on a real level and then also on this this symbolic level.
Okay, I have a question.
Because
I got into an argument with someone recently, a guy I've worked with, who... I would think he like works in the industry. I would think that he, most people who love movies and stuff like that love the Coen Brothers, right?
Mm-hmm.
He hates the Coen Brothers. He hates Barton Fink, and his criticism was the Coen Brothers like to show you characters who don't grow or change, or something like that. So my question is, does Barton Fink change over the course of this movie?
I think he does, although I don't think he necessarily has like a positive change where he becomes a more caring person.
Right.
I think more like he this is kind of the first step of like a newbie writer adapting to the Hollywood studio system at the time. Like you start out all idealistic, but by the end, you know, Lipnick's giving him the speech about how your script is crap, and he's just kind of sitting there and taking it and like, oh, this is my fate, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm gonna just like Mayhew is, that's me in the future. Now I'm going to be locked in a room writing crap scripts and forever and never getting any fame. That's like the beginning of him becoming kind of Hollywood jaded, I guess.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a change, but it's not like a big...
Yeah, it's not the...
Yeah.
But he was already not into it when he was convinced to do it in the beginning. He was like, oh, I can't do this because of my art and I'm so...
That's true,
but now he's
trapped here, you know? He always kind of wanted to just go to L.A. temporarily so that he could make a little scratch, return to New York, and start working on his real art. But now he doesn't even have that option because he has under contract. The contents of his mind are the property of Capitol Pictures.
Yeah, I love that.
Say. Yeah, that was great.
Yeah.
So good. How great are those stakes when Luke gets fired is so funny.
Oh,
how that ramps it up. It's just like, he will not apologize. And then he gets down on his knees and kisses
literally
his shoe.
Kisses his feet.
Oh,
yeah.
Great.
I know. That's an amazing scene. It's hilarious, but... I think you pointed out, Jackie, as we were watching, it doesn't make sense that he would supplicate himself in this way.
Yeah.
I mean, we know that he likes to kind of pretend that, oh, the writer is king at Capitol Pictures, and this is just kind of him going along with that. But would he really go to that level? Like, I'm going to kiss this man's feet?
Yeah, I don't think so, but it was hilarious.
And I think it represents this schizophrenic attitude of Hollywood and that the two-facedness that people will say whatever you want.
Yeah.
I remember when I first started working at a place, one of my criticisms of like one of the you know, the producers at this place was like, when he first met me, he was like the nicest guy ever. And he's like, great, what do you do? You want to be right? Blah, blah, blah. We'll go out. Let's get lunch sometime and we'll talk about what you want to do. We'll talk about your project. Did we ever get lunch? ever in the 5 years I worked for him, did we ever once ever get lunch? No. But did I get him lunch many times? Many. Countless times. You know, and I just think that's so such a classic. Like, because when I first met him, I was like, this guy's awesome.
Yeah.
And then after being around, I don't think he was a terrible person. I just think it was like, it was a fake gesture.
Yeah. There's this total LA fakeness that's kind of perfectly captured.
This is
a portrait of two brothers from Minneapolis who came to LA, and this is like their perspective of what that's like.
Yeah.
Which bleeds into the hell angle also.
Oh yeah. 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 So here's my first things I wrote down in my notes. Writing is hell. Writing for Hollywood is hell.
Yeah.
Hollywood is hell.
Literally hell.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's like the pretty obvious metaphors that keep getting hit.
Yeah. You know, things like the camera, when you see the camera move, it always moves down. It never moves up.
Oh.
And we're constantly descending. We're constantly getting a little bit lower. When he first gets in the elevator to the Hotel Earl, he mentions the number 6 3 times.
Yeah.
All these little things. And it's really made explicit by the time you get to that flaming hallway scene, which is
the one
he really
comes bringing fire with him.
Yeah. And yelling, "I'll show you the life of the mind," which, not subtle in the slightest, but it's kind of thrilling to watch that. Like, okay, we're just going for it here. We're going balls out crazy.
Yeah,
I respect that.
It was awesome. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's why I love the turn in Barton Fink where it gets so crazy, because it's like, I think the first act is setting it up. The second act is so crazy because I think my theory is that Barton's trying to give the studio what they want.
Yeah,
you know, right.
Yeah.
And then in the third act, the ending I think is Barton's poetic ending. You know, that's him like, "I was trying to give them poetry."
Right. Mm. He's trying to show them
I've
something real.
I've got 100 writers that could give me that Barton Fink feel.
Yeah. Oh yeah, no, fully just knocking him down at the very end. Like,
I think
you
I just butchered another quote, but it was close.
You think you're special, but you're not. You think what's rattles around in that little head of yours is special, but it's not.
Yeah.
Or like when he was at that USO show, you know, it's pointed out, this is right after Pearl Harbor is when all this stuff happens. The US is just about to go to war, and he's not going to let the girls dance with his dame because what they do isn't important. What he does is important.
He's a writer.
He's a creator, damn it. It's so well played.
Yeah.
There are World War II and Holocaust overtones going on in this all over the place, too.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. How many times do they use the slurs for Jewish people?
Yeah, a couple of kike drops in there for sure.
Mm-hmm. Kike drops.
Yeah. The two fast-talking cops who show up in the Hotel World.
The line about his hair. He says something like, there's some crazy line about it being curly. It's like...
Was it, I got some stories that would make your hair curl, but
it looks like you already
heard
him.
Yeah. Those two cops who say, "Fink, that's a Jewish name, huh? I didn't think this place was restricted."
Oh, yeah.
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 Crazy.
Coming from two cops, by the way, named Deutsch and Mastrianati. German and an Italian on the eve of World War II.
Wow, there you go.
When Charlie/Munt actually kills the guy before he pulls the trigger, he says Heil Hitler.
Yeah, for just no reason.
Whoa, it's like, I didn't even hear that.
Yeah, I didn't catch that the first time I saw it either.
Yeah, on top of everything else, he's just like, if you don't think I'm evil, Heil Hitler.
Whoa, right. I didn't catch that at all.
Yeah.
And I saw, I don't know if I agree with this interpretation, but I saw an interpretation online saying that Charlie/Munt is essentially supposed to represent fascism. I don't know how true that is, but at least like this is the real evil that you should be recognizing.
Okay, but here's something else that I thought. I thought when he said Heil Hitler, he might almost be joking. I felt like there's a reading of the way he says it that he almost might be like making fun of them in some way.
I think that's possible too.
Huh.
Yeah, I mean he's being sarcastic about the whole life of the mind thing too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Hmm.
I don't know. If I it's great. There's so many themes bouncing around. If I did have to boil it down to one theme, I really do think it is about the life of the mind, essentially, and it is kind of about solipsism and what happens and the pitfalls you fall into when you're completely in your own head.
Yeah.
Not willing to engage with the world around you. Not willing to listen to other people. You're just all about yourself and your mission, and you're wrestling with your own soul, essentially, and it leads you down just dark paths and paths mm-hmm. that won't get you anywhere. Until people are literally like burning your mind down, I guess.
I mean, I couldn't help but notice, like in Blood Simple too, where I mean, presumably his family's killed because he told this guy where his family is, which when that was happening, I was like, why are you telling this guy where your family is? But
yeah. Yeah, that's so creepy. The fact that his like parents end up dead at the end.
Yeah, like theory. They have to, I think. So again, it's like in Blood Simple where it's like one person's left standing after like all these horrible things happen, like the girl's murdered in his bed and like all these people die. And then it's like, well, live with it. Like, yeah. I hope you have a nice life after that. So I keep like wondering, like, I don't know, like maybe these guys just get killed off for their own, you know, not being a, like not having a tortured life for the rest of their life, but they have to like live with it, which I find really interesting. So
yeah, you know, at the end, Charlie doesn't actually hurt Barton in any way. He just
sets him free
and then says, oh, by the way, I visited your parents and your Uncle Maury.
We're all nice people, yeah. Whatever he said.
I guess that's a different kind of hell to leave a guy in.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I like that they, I feel like there's a change that you expect him to be totally unredeemable and the monster, but then like they put that little redemptive moment in there where he sets Barton free and and he becomes that sort of sweetheart again before he leaves.
As he says, he says he just wants to help people. You know,
but that again too, it's like maybe maybe the nicer thing would have been to put him out of his misery. Like I know it seems sweet, but at the same time, like I don't think it's
right because now he's just got to.
Now it's like now he's left with this shit. Like I don't know. I feel like after all that, that was all very torturous. But it's like it's like a little bit of a play.
Yeah.
Whether he's sweet or not.
Somehow, I keep noticing this too, that except for the first time we see Charlie actually knocks on the door of Barton's room. The first time we see him. Every time after that, he just opens the door.
Mm.
Which, I don't know if hotels were different in the 40s. I don't think you could just open the door to another person's room and let yourself in. He just lets himself in.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Fight Club.
Yeah. I don't know if I'd go full Tyler Durden, although there are kind of moments where, like, you know, he passes out during the period that Charlie carries Audrey and cuts off his head, her head or whatever, deals with the body. Maybe
could be him.
Maybe Charlie's just another side of his personality.
Yeah. Mm.
Ooh, yeah.
The word head is mentioned 60 times in the screenplay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The word mind is mentioned a bunch of times, too.
Oh, cool.
Charlie says he sells peace of mind when he says he's an insurance salesman. And then the cops show up and they say, Munt, he's got a way of ventilating people's heads with a shotgun.
Wow.
Yeah. Just all these things blowing up heads.
Ugh.
This is the first movie that for the Coen brothers that Roger Deakins did the cinematography for. For the first three movies, they did Barry Sonnenfeld did the cinematography, but then he went on to direct The Addams Family, and they had to find a new guy. They
I like him better.
You like him better, really?
Yeah. A little more gimmicky.
He is a little more gimmicky. That's the reason I don't like him as much.
Yeah, I know.
The Coen brothers actually sought out Roger Deakins for this. They liked his work on Sid and Nancy, and they were like, we want you to work with us in our
eyes. There were good parts, though.
And he's after this, he becomes the de facto cinematographer for every Coen brothers movie.
I think I've seen Sid and Nancy. It's pretty... it's the Sid Vicious story, right?
Yeah, it's the Sid Vicious story.
Pretty bleak.
Very much so, yeah.
Grimy sort of movie, huh?
But no, he might be the best, like, DP that in the world. He's incredible. He's just amazing at setting up shots. And the Coen brothers are his main collaborator. And I think this is from this point forward, he essentially becomes the third Coen brother, kind of their main visual collaborator.
Yeah, it was still very good. But there are some parts where I was like, could have done a little
How did they do the shot that opens the movie with the feather that floats down to him on the bench when he's sitting on the bench?
That probably took a lot of different work, but it really perfectly sets at the moment where you see Sally Field show up and
Forrest Gump.
I don't remember the movies and that. I don't remember Forrest Gump, and I don't remember that scene in the actual movie.
Okay, that final scene. Let's talk about that final scene.
Yes.
Yeah, that final moment where finally the picture comes true.
Yes.
Is that a real scene, or is that just another fantasy moment in another escape? Seems like another scene that could be entirely in Barton's head, his way of coping with the fact that he's essentially a slave to Capitol Pictures now.
Yeah. 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 And I think that's the... when the big boss is... Again, I'll keep harping on my theme, that, you know, that's the scene that Barton wrote for himself that makes it the ultimate self-obsessed. Like,
right.
And he finally gets what he wants, which is this nice, safe, clean sex and on the beach and broad daylight, and it's just a girl. And
it's true. It's not even sex. It's just him looking at a pretty girl. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say it's not even sex. It's just, like, so pure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Yeah, like, looking at her.
No, definitely, yeah. There's definitely the undercurrent throughout that in Barton Fink, like, sex is equated with death. He first sleeps with this girl, and then the girl shows up dead immediately.
Yeah, his worst nightmare. Yeah.
Lots of sick Freudian stuff going on.
And yeah, also and that pipe. What the
pipe
hell?
As it goes down, like, it's the worst, grossest image yes. of a vagina. You know, it's like, so he's like horrified by
such
it.
Such a great yeah. joke shot, yeah, just to go down the pipes, yeah. you know, see what's inside
happening.
The pipe.
Ugh, why?
It's like, is that what Barton's thinking about while they're having sex?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Is he thinking about, oh,
ew. Ew, vagina, gross.
What I wrote down is, how is this pipe scene real? Like, it was too much.
That's so unrealistic.
never living this down.
I mentioned the execs in this movie. So a lot of the people in the movie were kind of based on real people, though in a very obviously caricatured mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. That Lipnick is kind of a hybrid of Louis B. Mayer and Jack Warner.
That
Mayhew is supposed to be kind of a William Faulkner type,
mm-hmm.
This
mm-hmm.
great Southern novelist who goes to Hollywood and kind of gets lost.
Yeah.
And Barton Fink himself is supposed to be a writer named Clifford Odets. We don't know if you know who that is.
Uh-uh.
He was a very big playwright in the 30s, and he was very into writing stories about, like, yeah, real people and the common man. That was kind of his theme that he kind of worked on. As opposed to... As Barton kind of flippantly says, like, the Lady Higginbottom and Professor Plumpsworth, and like, yeah. I guess those kind of, you know, silly kind of farcical pictures that were all a thing at the time. He was trying to do something real. And also his reputation has kind of faded over time, that he seems a little too earnest now. This movie was made for $9 million, but it made only $6 million at the box office.
Aww.
I gotta say, if you're trying to sell a film, calling it Barton Fink probably isn't a title that's gonna get yeah. people into theaters.
And, I mean, isn't this movie sort of box office poison?
It is. Yeah. It is, yeah. It's this is them making, I think, a really great movie,
yeah.
but it's definitely not a movie. It's not a right. B-picture. It's not a movie that's gonna sell to,
exactly.
to common folks.
Yeah. Which is yeah. ironic, right? Because, yeah.
It is a little ironic. Yeah. It's definitely kind of ironic. This
but
is
I
one of the
really like that about them, too. So.
Yeah. This is for sure one of their less accessible pictures.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of cool stuff going on.
They tried to give us poetry, guys.
They did.
And
yeah.
we only gave them $6 million in return.
Yeah, we're like, we don't get it.
Yeah.
We just want to see something straightforward.
We just want to see wrestling pictures.
Yeah. And a dame.
According to the Coen brothers, they have a sequel in mind for this movie.
Ooh.
Called Old Fink. which would follow Barton Fink in the 60s when he's a college professor.
Cool.
They say they've only been waiting until John Turturro is old enough to play the part.
Oh, that's wow. awesome.
Which might actually be coming soon.
Oh, that's so cool. Well, they could also make him look a little older too already.
They could if they wanted to. So
like 20 years, yeah.
Yeah, the Coens don't do a lot of sequels, but that's actually what I'd be excited for. Yeah.
Man, that would be awesome.
That would be pretty cool.
Yeah.
So yeah, just a final overall thoughts, and what did you guys think about this film?
I liked it, but it was a day that I was unhappy to begin with, so it wasn't.
You were in a bad mood to start with, and I think you wanted you wanted some crowd pleasing popcorn
for whatever
movie.
Reason. So I like to not read descriptions, and I don't know if you know this, but I haven't seen any Coen Brothers movies. So yeah,
wow.
for real, yeah. So that's why I'm
real
the best
deal.
Co-host ever. but
I hate movies.
Oh my god,
this,
okay,
is, so,
you know
this is so fun.
I'm gonna explain myself right now since you use that little sound bite. Weirdly enough, and maybe this is why I kind of like even related to Barton too, is like I think I do hate a lot of movies because I don't like gimmicky stuff or things that don't make sense. And I like a movie that's more like this, which is like kind of messing with you and like a little more cerebral. This is like definitely more my kind of beat, which is why I hate most movies. But so I'm Barton. I hadn't read the description, so I didn't even know that Barton Fink had anything to do with like some murder crazy stuff.
No,
which is in the description on the
I deliberately kept you on the, in the dark on this one. I was I want to see your look of shock when she ends up dead in the bed.
Yeah, like, no, what? I mean, I could have. Oh, geez. I mean, I put that down like, what? Like, what?
Yeah.
But I mean, I could have read the description on Netflix, but I just chose not to because I love being surprised. Like,
yeah.
I hate all kinds of spoilers and I consider a description a spoiler.
So this was surprising, right? To go in the direction she expected.
Totally. But so I don't know why in my mind, like when I hear like Barton Fink, that to me kind of sounds like a fun movie. Barton Fink, like this like nevishy Jewish guy or something.
This goofy neurotic character.
Something
you know?
Like that. Yeah. So I was like, this is a murder movie now? Oh, great. So like that was not helpful, but I really liked it because I love all the different interpretations of it. I like that I also do not have a final opinion on what the movie's actually about. Like I'll have to rewatch it and think about it some more. So I like that. So
we just told you.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I have to decide who's right.
Yeah.
We just solved the whole thing. No.
Yeah. And it could be about fascism and
yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's one of Tom Hanks' best movies. I think it's one of his best performances, and like the place he goes with that character is just unbelievable. It's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, to play a dumb guy when he's so smart.
He played that's it got, so sweet.
It's just
too, yeah.
It's brave. It's a brave performance.
Very brave.
Case dismissed. That was really mean.
Case dismissed.
After watching this movie, I think the person I was talking to who thinks that the Coen brothers suck, I think he's totally wrong, and I have less respect for this person. So if you're listening, you know who you are.
Ooh,
I have less respect for
burn.
You. I think this is if there's a movie that has this many layers and like is so entertaining and so many great performances, so much great writing, so many different interpretations, how can you hate that?
That's the thing. Yeah. You know, I did talk about this being a little inaccessible, and it is not like a, you know, like a Save the Cat type movie or whatever, mm-hmm. but there's such big performances. Michael Lerner is so much fun. Tony Shalhoub is hilarious.
So
with his he's taken it interested you. He likes you. Never make Lipnick like you. A lot of Nebuchadnezzar Jewish kind of stereotypes in this movie, but
totally.
It's the Coen brothers making it, so it's okay.
But I think there's a lot of accessible parts, even if the whole film itself may be inaccessible, like you don't know what the story is. I'm undecided, there's parts that I totally, like, definitely connect to, so...
I think it's super accessible. It's on Netflix.
Well, you know what? Not everybody has high-speed internet, okay? So don't be condescending. Some people don't have Netflix access. Some people go to Redbox. Anyhow, if you have not seen Barton Fink, why are you listening to this? But because we just spoiled the whole thing for
that.
You. But this is one of my favorite Coen Brothers films for sure, just because there is so much going on, and I've seen it four or five times at this point, and I find new layers and new details every time, and that's the sign of a great movie to me, is that there is, and it's an immersive world, and even if it is like a world that's largely inside a character's head or largely symbolic or metafictional, There's so many things going on in so many layers, and on a technical level, the visuals, the sound, and it all really comes together.
Yeah. My only criticism of this movie was if you're going to have a sex scene in a movie, you should show boobs.
Yeah. They just cut away. They cut to the drain pipe.
Yeah.
There's nothing sexy about that.
It's a rip, you know?
Yeah.
I think you do see her boobs actually when she's like covered in blood, but maybe that's not what
you're not really.
I have to go back and rewind.
I'm trying to think what Coen. Big Lebowski, you see boobs in that.
Yeah, there you go.
Spoiler, thank you.
Sorry. Total boobs, yeah. Boobs on a trampoline, no less.
Yeah.
Come on, leave me with something.
You have not seen Big Lebowski?
No, is that crazy?
I know. Isn't this is why Jackie's my co-host.
I don't know how I do this, but it's like I avoid spoilers for anything that I just don't. I mean, if you guys spoil Big Lebowski, that would suck. But I just generally like get through life very stubbornly avoiding things that I don't want to be spoiled. And I've made it this far.
Yeah.
Wow.
No reason, just because I hate movies.
Well, I know. Well, I can't wait.
I'm very excited.
I'm jealous of that. Like, I wish I could watch Lebowski.
I know.
It's going to be really
exciting.
It's going to be really exciting.
It's going to be exciting sitting next to you and watching you watch these movies for the first time.
Yeah.
Yep.
Anyhow, that's it for Barton Fink. We only have one segment left on this show, which is something... I know you're excited for this, Jackie.
Uh-huh.
It's a segment called Raising Arquizona. This is a segment where we have a 10-question multiple-choice quiz loosely inspired by the film. In this case, the loose inspiration I took from Barton Fink is hotels. I have 10
Seems
questions
boring.
All about... There's, trust me, it's not. Lots of interesting hotel trivia.
Okay, I'm going to suck at it.
We're going to be having Jackie face off against Joe to see who knows more about these hotel facts. And so far, Jackie is 2-for-2 on these quizzes.
Yeah.
I think she wants to get back to a winning record. So, Joe, you may have some competition.
I don't know
on this
about
one.
This. If this is going to be, this sounds not in my wheelhouse. Hotel trivia.
I don't know. You say you've been around.
I've been to a lot
of hotels. Super 8, Econolodge.
I named 3 or 4. That's expert.
that puts you in the expert category to me.
Okay.
It's going to be tough.
Here we go. Question number 1.
Oh, by the way, you should say ding when you know the answer.
Oh yeah, when you know the answer, just say ding. We'll have they're all multiple choice. They're all 3 answers, and we'll have each of you say your answer.
Yeah.
Question number 1: Which of these is not a real hotel? A. In New York, Godiva has a hotel room made entirely out of chocolate. B. In Atlanta, Coca-Cola has a room shaped like an enormous Coke bottle where guests can sleep. C. In Stockholm, IKEA has a hotel inside one of its stores. Which of those is not real?
I just want to get this question over with because I have no idea.
Mm,
and
think about
tough.
What doesn't seem real.
I'm going to say ding and say...
You have really bad tells, by the way. Work on that.
I'm not giving anything away. He hasn't even said anything yet.
Yeah, but I'm getting excited.
I'm going to say a chocolate.
That's what I was going to say, too, so we're good.
All right. Whew. You guys both say chocolate?
We're wrong.
You guys are both wrong.
Case dismissed.
But, like, I want to know, are people staying in this room?
Okay, the Godiva room cannot be slept in, but exactly. It is a real room.
That's not a hotel room.
That's the only reason I didn't pick that. Okay, well, I don't know if I would have got it anyway.
If guests can't stay in it, that's not a hotel room.
They constructed a hotel room, bed, walls, toiletries.
That's an art installation.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I believe that you have to be able to stay in this exhibit.
Agreed.
Yeah, that's why I picked it, because it's like, that's health
exactly.
That's a health violation.
You know what?
You can't sleep in chocolate.
Case dismissed. We win this quiz.
We win this one. Okay.
You can't both win the quiz.
What is the right?
The right answer is the Coca-Cola room is fit.
That was my B.
Yeah.
I'll safely announce from the in hindsight.
But IKEA does have a hotel inside one of their stores if you're getting tired while you're shopping, you can just take a nap.
Still technicality. I want to give us each a point though.
All right, you guys both have... Fine, you have 0 points both so far. Sorry.
Okay.
Fine. I'll allow it.
Question number two. Many hotels in Las Vegas, like the Wynn and the Rio, have no floors that start with the number 4. The elevators go straight from 39 to 51. Why is this? A, the number 4 is considered bad luck in China. B, it makes the buildings seem taller than they really are. C, Bugsy Siegel was killed on the 40th floor of the Flamingo Hotel.
One more time.
A, the number 4 is considered bad luck in China. B, it makes the buildings seem taller than they really are. C, Bugsy Siegel was killed on the 40th floor of the Flamingo Hotel. Which is the real reason?
I hate this quiz.
This is a tough one.
Ugh, I hate movies.
Ugh, come on. You're breaking your concentration.
Yeah, I don't know if I don't know.
I can tell you guys are real game players because you're both waiting for the other person to make a move and you're figuring out what they're to match. Yeah.
No, that's why I was excited for this one because I know Joe's competitive too.
The number 4 is considered bad luck in China.
We know the answer.
It makes the buildings seem taller than they really are.
I hate your voice right now.
Bugsy Siegel was killed on the 40th floor of the Flamingo Hotel.
You know what? I'm just...
This is tense.
I'm going to...
What if we just say at the
I'm gonna
same time?
I'm going to say C.
We both said C.
You both say C?
No, I'm scaring my dog.
You're both wrong. Also.
Oh, come on. This is...
Okay.
My next one is A.
The real answer is Chinese high rollers are so important to Vegas casinos, they go out of their way to make them feel good. And many Chinese people believe the number 4 is bad luck. So they get rid of all the floors that start with 4.
That seems like a thing.
You know, that makes sense because we do that already with 13 for
right.
us. So
right.
that seemed believable. But I just did the other one. You know why?
Why?
The most specific information.
Yeah.
Bugsy Siegel.
See, I'm throwing you off with specifics. Yeah. Bugsy Siegel was not killed in the Flamingo Hotel. He just started it. I make shit up.
But you know what? Okay, whatever. We both lost. That's fine. Keep
all right.
moving.
Question number 3. 20 of the 25 biggest hotels in the world are in Las Vegas. But the very biggest one is not. What country is it in? A.
United Arab Emirates, Dubai.
A is Malaysia. B is Dubai. C is North Korea.
B.
So you're already saying B. Jackie, are you going to match him or go with something else?
Very smart answer. He already knew the answer before it was an option. It was tough. So far, we've been giving the same answers.
Go out on a limb. Take a risk.
Yeah.
I've heard that before. It never went well.
Malaysia?
I heard the answers.
UAE?
I would have probably said UAE, though, because of how big all their stuff is. You know what? I'm just going to say Malaysia just for kicks and just to make this more interesting.
Jackie gets a point.
Oh,
bam!
My God.
Are
you kidding me? It's not Dubai.
Yes. Yes.
The Genting Highlands Casino, also known as the, quote, fun city above the cloud, is the only legal land-based casino in Malaysia.
Give me a break.
Yeah, okay.
It also boasts the world's fastest sky cable car system, which goes up to 13 miles per hour.
Wow.
What a thrill ride.
Wow, that probably clinched the game right there.
Right?
It's been neck and neck.
Yeah. Question number 4. Why was Britney Spears temporarily banned from the Chateau Marmont at the height of her public meltdown phase in 2007? A, for walking around the hotel pantsless. B, for breaking into another guest's room to take a nap. C, for smearing her face with food at the restaurant.
Looking at me? I'm just going to say B.
I'm going to say B, too.
You're both saying B? You're both wrong. You're both bad at this game. Wow.
No. All right.
Whatever. Other diners were so disgusted with Mrs. Spears' juvenile eating habits that they complained to the staff who kicked her out.
Really?
Yeah.
She's smearing food
it
on her
face?
It
seems like you could get away with like the pantsless and the food thing, but I felt like maybe breaking into somebody's
B&E
room.
Is no, serious, see, yeah.
That's the thing. Marmont, you know, they got a lot of high-profile guests, and if you piss them off, you're in trouble.
Wow.
Interesting.
Yeah. And in this case, I guess she was playing with her food a little bit too much.
Okay.
Question number five. Some Vegas casinos spend $35,000 a month on aroma management, which is often performed by a company called Aromasys that gives, like, Mandalay Bay a Southeast Asian smell, and the Bellagio has an Italy smell. the Venetian has a distinctive blend that they call Seduction.
Wow.
Yeah, so they design, like, designer smells for all these casinos. And they also created the smell system for which of these fast food companies?
Wait, who makes all the casinos smell like cigarette smoke?
I think smokers.
Smokers, right? Okay.
Yeah, don't blame Aromasys for that.
Okay.
But Aromasys also created a smaller smell system for which of these companies? A, Subway. B, Dunkin' Donuts. C, Cinnabon.
A, ding, Subway.
Jackie?
Oh, shit.
Do you, like, know that one? You seem so confident. It's throwing me off.
Don't worry about it.
I'm worried about it, but you know what? The worst that can happen
there
is
real,
a tie.
There's real gamesmanship going on.
I have second thoughts about that, but go. So I'm not super confident.
Cinnabon seems so obvious and annoying.
Don't try to read my tells.
I'm going to be able to hear it when I listen to the podcast again, but I'm just going to say Dunkin' Donuts. I don't know why.
We got a Subway and we got a Dunkin' Donuts, and you're both wrong again.
It's Cinnabon,
Jesus
yeah.
Christ, I can't. This is what I hate. Okay.
Darn it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they pump
it was
artificial.
Too obvious.
They,
I hate.
Yeah, they pump artificial cinnamon smell to their customers.
There you go.
And FYI, Subway claims they have no smell machine. You're just smelling their
it's
fresh
the bread.
Baked bread.
Yeah. Darn it.
Why did you think it was Subway?
Because of that. Because you smell their.
They
fresh
do have that
bread.
Very distinctive smell. Yeah.
But I should have waited because Cinnabon seems more obvious. You know, yeah. I was just in a hotel. In Dallas, and it was one of these really fancy hotels, and it had a smell, and that makes sense because we were talking about it. We're like, what is, you know, do these places pump like this cologne kind of weird smell in? And yeah, I think the answer is yes, they do.
Yeah, they 100% do. A lot of people complain about like the Venetian smell. Apparently, they say it's like somebody who wears too much cologne.
Yeah,
but I guess that's their thing.
Italian, yeah.
I am not doing well here.
Halfway through this game,
it's
Jackie's
okay.
up by 1 point. You can still get. You can still come back.
You can turn this around.
The worst anybody has ever done.
Yeah, so far you guys are both sucking at hotels. Question number six.
Topic.
Which of these is not a true story pulled from a Reddit thread on hospitality workers' worst guest encounters?
All right,
so here's three stories. A, most guests don't tip the cleaning staff at all, so I was pleasantly surprised to find a $20 bill waiting for me after one older man checked out. When he picked up the bill, I discovered the bottom half was covered in semen. B, always check the seals on the things in the mini bar. I once had a guest who had drunk the whiskey and then peed in the bottle, closed it, and put it back.
I believe that one.
C. A guest at a central hotel in Stockholm showed up in a suit and with a briefcase, very proper, paid in cash up front, said bye the next day when he checked out. When the cleaners later came into the room, the walls were smeared with feces top to bottom.
Ding. C is not...
See, it's not real.
Yeah, I think it's going to take too much feces, is my logic, top to bottom.
Oh, I'm thoughtful. I'm just going to take a risk and do A.
Jackie gets another point.
Give me a break.
That was made up.
How does he have that much feces? Top to bottom makes me think,
you know,
the whole thing
if
is
you,
covered.
If you have a multi-night stay and you're collecting your feces the whole time,
okay.
and if you're careful about using the right amount on each wall, I think you can make it last.
I am a sore loser right now.
You don't have
to bottle it up, by the way, because I yell and get upset. So I'm just saying, it's not... Don't.
Come on, who knows anything about hotels?
You still have a chance.
Okay,
there's four more questions.
I don't know anything about hotels.
I'm going to come back. Greatest comeback in history.
All right. Question seven. In 1909, a man named George Pullman entered London's Savoy Hotel dressed in fine clothes. He asked where he could find automobile tires, which was a sign of obvious wealth in 1909. Then he ordered a suite of rooms in the penthouse. Then he asked to be taken to the Savoy Jewelers to view their collection of diamond rings. He selected a few he liked, and then he asked the jeweler to come with him to his suite to show the rings to his wife. The jeweler, whose name was Penton, stood outside the suite as Pullman entered the suite with the rings, appearing to talk to a female voice. But Penton became suspicious when the voices stopped, and then a couple seconds later, a man in a cap and a heavy overcoat emerged from an adjacent room moments later, which was Pullman in disguise with the rings. Pullman reacted by starting to cough and ask for help, basically faking medical distress. The jeweler wouldn't have it. He stood in the doorway of the hallway to block his path until help arrived. But Pullman found a way to escape. How did he escape? A. He slit his own throat, prompting the jeweler to run for help. B. He tossed the rings out the window and escaped when Penton ran to retrieve them. C. He jumped out the window himself, hoping to survive the fall. How did he escape?
Oh, idiot.
Man, these are tough.
I'm going to say B.
He tossed the rings out the window.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to pick something that's not that.
Okay.
Because I'm going to try to win this.
You should. Yeah, you should. That's good gameplay.
I'm going to say he jumped out the window.
You got tossed the rings out the window, we got jumped out the window, and you're both wrong.
Oh, Jeez, my gosh.
This is the worst quiz you have ever made. So I just
he slit his own throat with a razor.
Oh, my God.
The jeweler ran to get medical help, but then he was gone when he came back. But he left a trail of blood going down the stairs. Wow. So the jeweler followed the trail of blood and then found him collapsed on the staircase. He died moments later. Not a smart way to escape.
Oh, so he didn't escape. Again, I have problems with the...
Yeah, technicality. We don't like this one.
He technically got out of the locked, you know, the locked hallway. But, all right, three more questions.
Jeez.
Question number 8. According to a recent hotel survey, towels are the most popular item stolen from hotels every year. What is the second most popular item? A, soap and shampoo bottles. B, batteries. C, pillows.
Okay.
Batteries, ding.
Yeah, I was going to say batteries because shampoo is free, so I don't get it.
You're both right on this one.
Darn it. You couldn't pick something else, could you?
Well, she's a win. She tries to win.
Batteries are valuable.
Yeah.
They'll take
They'll take batteries out of the remote control.
Yeah.
Oftentimes.
There you go.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
All right. Question number 9. The Palmer House Hilton in Chicago is America's oldest still running hotel.
So I can't win.
You could tie.
I could tie still?
You might be able to tie.
Sorry,
okay,
Joe.
Because I have 1 point. But wait, don't you have 3 points?
Jackie's up by 2 right now.
Okay.
So you can get these next two.
I get it.
The Palmer House in Chicago is a historic hotel for many reasons. Among them, when Bertha Palmer, who is married to the founder of the hotel, asked the kitchen to produce a portable dessert for the 1893 World's Fair. The kitchen invented A, the ice cream cone. B, the lollipop. C, the brownie.
The kitchen invented one of those three things in 1893.
In 1893 for the World's Fair.
Say B, lollipop.
Yeah, Joe, if you want to get ahead, you're going to have to choose someone other than
that. Yeah, A, ice cream.
You're both wrong again.
The brownie?
It was the brownie. They invented the brownie.
Brownies?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, I can't win now. Oh man.
I'm not even satisfied because all these...
That is so frustrating.
How are you guys getting all these wrong? There's only three options.
This is
a hard question. This is tough.
All right. Okay. Well, there's only one question left. Like, we might as well play this out to the end.
Okay.
Question number 10. The Ryugyong Hotel in North Korea is a 105-story pyramid-shaped hotel, officially the tallest hotel in the world, but it has never been officially opened. It's been under construction for 25 years, and thanks to the limited natural resources in North Korea, the hotel was built with no windows, poor quality concrete, and crooked elevator shafts, so it's never been cleared to open for the public. Some nicknames for this hotel include the Hotel of Doom and the Worst Building in the World. How much has been spent on construction of this hotel to date? A, $250 million. B, $500 million. C, $750 million.
I don't know. I mean...
Who cares anymore anyway?
What's 500 versus 750? Who cares?
Right. At a certain point, it's still a ridiculous amount of money.
Yeah, let's just say 750. $1 million.
That is really what I was going to say.
Okay, you're both right on this one. Yeah.
Great.
Which is, by the way, 2% of North Korea's GDP on a single building.
Wow.
Yeah. Which has still never been open to the public.
Wow. See, I just want to point out that there was a question where you were like, oh, which one's the tallest hotel? And you didn't, that one was one of the options, right? In North Korea.
That was the biggest hotel.
Biggest hotel.
Different. Okay. But different than the tallest hotel.
I just want to point out, because that would like cancel out your whole chocolate hotel room question.
No, it's like the hotel with the most rooms. Nothing cancels out my chocolate hotel room question. It's still a legitimate question.
It's not.
Jackie.
Yeah, that one's got to get tossed out.
Ugh.
Whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, this wraps up this episode of Accept the Mystery.
Good times. Good times.
Yeah. Yeah, this was awesome, guys. Thank you all for joining me. Joe, is there anything you'd like to plug? Any place where people can find your stuff online?
Twitter. I like Twitter a lot. Check it out at Joe Hartzler, HARTZLER.
Cool.
I like Twitter.
I have Twitter too.
You have a Twitter too.
We know it. It's MACQUELINE. It's not funny. Nothing cool happens on it.
Don't
follow me anyway.
Don't say that if you're trying to get people to follow you on Twitter.
Well, I retweeted about it. It's fine. But I'm great to follow. I'm just not funny.
Just tweet funny things.
I don't make jokes, so it's just not gonna work.
So why should? So wait. So then make the case why people should follow you.
Yeah.
I'm nice.
So sometimes you just get nice things on your Twitter feed.
Look, I'm a casual Twitter person, right?
You're pretty serious compared
to
me.
No, but let's pretend I'm not me.
Oh, okay.
I'm just a casual Twitter. Right. I follow 350 people. Okay. I don't follow many people.
Okay.
Like, not me. I follow too many people. But regular person.
Right.
What puts it over the top? What seals the deal? I gotta follow you. Why do I go click follow?
Yeah, I have a real question about that, because I do have people who follow me. I'm not sure why, because I feel like I have too many different things going on my Twitter.
What do you feel like you use it for?
I mostly talk to Josh on it.
To
be fair.
See, you gotta have a Twitter persona.
Yeah, I'm working on it. My Twitter's gonna end up being an Instagram.
Yeah, maybe in real life you're just normal Jackie, but on Twitter you're like, you're bad Jackie. You control shit and you can say things.
That's not
abandoned.
I can't, because I'm a lawyer, so I can't be like publicly tweeting like the bed. Outside of me. I tweeted a lot of fashion law stuff because that was a lot of what I do, but then I also do entertainment now, but then there's like all this comedy stuff, so it's a really weird mix of like fashion and comedy. I'm a renaissance woman on my Twitter.
Gotta follow.
Yeah, fashion. Thanks, entertainment, Joe. Comedy, my three favorite things. You can follow me at Radio TFB on Twitter. You can check out other stuff I do at joshrichmond.net. We have a website for this show now. It's accepthemystery.net, where you can go and find out more stuff about like what the concept of the show is and what we do, and where you can find these movies if you're interested in watching them for yourself or haven't seen them for a while, etc., etc. Anyhow, this was great, guys.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for coming on. It's always a pleasure to have
Anytime.
You back on the show, dude. Peace and love, y'all.
Yeah, more peace and love.
More peace and
I'll
love.
I'll show you the life of the mind.
I'll show you the life of the mind.
Awesome.